KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in our next Forum Hour, the bloody battles of World War I have been memorialized in classics such as All Quiet on the Western Front and through the verse of poets like Wilfred Owen. Now, cartoonist Joe Sacco revisits those trenches with his newest work, The Great War, a 24-foot-long drawing depicting the first day of the Battle of the Somme in 1916, which has been called the bloodiest 24 hours in the history of the British military. Joe Sacco and journalist and historian Adam Hochschild join us to discuss the art and impact of the Great War after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Described as the heir to cartoonist R. Crumb and Art Spiegelman, Joe Sacco won the American Book Award for his first book, Palestine, and his Safe Area Garajda was named by Time magazine as the best comic book of the year. He's done books on Gaza, Bosnia, and Sarajevo, as well as on Palestine, and his work has appeared in Time, the New York Times Magazine, Harper's, Granta, The Guardian, and the Virginia Quarterly Review. He recently published a book called On the Great War. It's an illustrated portrait of the July 16th Battle of the Somme in France, a turning point in the war that was supposed to end all wars. His illustrated history has been published in a 24-foot-long black-and-white panorama folded into an 8.5-by-11-inch box with an introduction by Bay Area veteran journalist and author Adam Hochschild, author of To End All Wars, A Study of Loyalty and Rebellion, 1914 to 1918. And Adam Hochschild is also the author of Bury the Chains and King Leopold's Ghost. And Joe Sacco and Adam Hochschild both join us for this Forum Hour. Welcome to both of you. Glad to have you both here.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
And Joe Sacco, I should mention, actually grew up in Malta and Australia. And you grew up with kind of a fascination with World War I. I mean, I know as living in Australia, Gallipoli played heavily in the forming of your boyhood imagination, but so did things like No Man's Land and gas warfare and, I mean, World War I generally.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I was reading about World War I since I was a kid. And, you know, I had this boyhood interest in that sort of thing. Biplanes, soldiers in gas masks. Yeah, and the very idea of something like No Man's Land, I took it quite literally. It seemed sort of horrific to me, even at the time. But growing up in Australia, they commemorate Anzac Day, and in school, class would stop and we would hear stories of Australian soldiers in the First World War. So the First World War sort of figured a lot into my consciousness at an early age.
Well, then we jump ahead, and there's a Norton editor, a former roommate of yours, who I guess in some alcohol-induced state, you two decided that you would do a book on World War I one day?
Well, yeah. His name's Matt Weiland, and we were roommates in New York City. And he was very taken with a book by Matteo Paracoli called Manhattan Unfurled, which is a great fold-out accordion-style book of the Manhattan skyline. And Matt told me, you know, it'd be great if you drew the Western Front. And of course, having had a few drinks, I agreed with him. And about 15 years later, he called me up. He just got a job at W.W. Norton and said, do you want to do this book? And I didn't want to do it. At first, I thought, oh, no. But then I thought, you know, I've spent so much time reading about the First World War. I probably have more books about the First World War than any other subject. And I thought, now's the time to redeem that boyhood interest and actually do something worthwhile from that.
So let's fast forward again. You're at the London Imperial War Museum. You're photocopying, probably setting some kind of almanac record for the number of things you photocopy. And then also there's the tapestry, the Norman Conquest, that comes into this as major inspiration for you.
Yeah. Being a cartoonist, I'm interested in narrative. And the idea of drawing a static image of the Western Front didn't really appeal to me. But it soon came clear to me, as I thought of the Bayeux tapestry, that I could tell a narrative that you could basically read from left to right, even if there were no words. I mean, the Bayeux tapestry does have words, but not many. And, it tells the story of the Norman Conquest.
And this is the first time you kind of felt liberated. You felt more like an artist in some ways than a journalist.
Yes. And I've for a while, I've thought of doing things other than journalism. And this was a way of making a bit of a break and of thinking about some of the same things I've done with journalism, but as an artist. And it was liberating.
And we, by the way, have a video on our website if you want to look at Joe's work. It's quite extraordinary, especially in the detail. It's a video. We couldn't get the whole picture of the accordion type of work that this is. But why black and white? Why not color?
Black and white because I don't know how to use color. I mean, quite honestly, I've never spent the time to learn how to use it. And I don't say that out of any sense of pride. But that's, you know, you have your limitations and you try to work as well as you can within those limitations.
And let's talk to Adam, who's sort of the resident historian here, about what's portrayed here, the Battle of the Somme. I mean, a landmark and very disillusioning, particularly for the British, to put it mildly, battle. Horror, death. I mean, suddenly all that idealism that all these British boys, many of them from Eton and Oxford, went off to fight it with was really crushed by this one battle, I mean, as it was throughout England.
That's true. But as we talk about the battle, I somehow want your listeners to be able to visualize this extraordinary piece of art that Joe has done. As you mentioned, it unfolds to 24 feet. But as you scan from left to right, you're not scanning the horizon. You're scanning in time, the preparations for the battle, the moving in of guns and men and equipment. Then the panels turn somewhat dark as it's night. Then they turn light as the battle begins, and you see the tremendous destruction and finally the wounded being carried off at the end.
And it starts with General Haig. And when I say General Haig, I don't mean Alexander, obviously.
Right.
Douglas Haig just pacing.
Yeah. Well, Douglas Haig was the British commander-in-chief on the Western Front at this time, and somehow the epitome of too many generals on both sides in this war who always felt that the next battle was going to be the successful big breakthrough that would solve the stalemate of the war, because the time we're talking about, July 1916, on the Western Front in northern France and a little corner of Belgium, both armies had been locked in place for the better part of 2 years, the trenches barely budging. And General Haig and all the British Army command under him felt that if we just hit the other side with enough artillery, then the troops can break through. And then, of course, what everyone was hoping for was that the cavalry would charge through, because you can't have a good war without cavalry. It had been that way for thousands of years. And so for a solid week, they shot off, I think it was roughly 1.5 million shells at the German trenches.
There's all this bombardment that a lot of it just turned out to be useless, really, wasn't it?
Yeah. If you look at documentary film footage from the First World War, you'll see these dramatic pictures of a shell landing and then it blows a huge geyser of earth into the air. Well, that's mostly what they did. They blew huge geysers of earth into the air, because if you're trying to knock out a German machine gun nest, of which there were roughly 1,000 in this section of the front, these were built of concrete, stone, steel. Unless you hit it with a direct hit, it was impossible to put out of action. And so all of this shelling essentially left almost all of the German machine gun nests intact. And when these poor British soldiers climbed out of their trenches, at 7:30 in the morning on July 1st, 1916, they were just mowed down like wheat.
10 million civilians, 21 million wounded. I mean, those are the numbers I saw.
For the whole war, the military death toll, nobody's sure of these numbers because, a lot of the countries involved, like Russia and Austria-Hungary, had sort of collapsed at the end. But military death toll probably around 9 or 9.5 million. Civilian death toll 10 to 12 million, and another 21 million wounded.
So one of the stupidest wars that's ever been fought, I think. I mean, one of the most senseless wars. There died a myriad, as Ezra Pound said, and the best among them. He said for a botched civilization, I don't know if I would go that far. But, there was a sense of just the utter futility. And like I said, I've often seen this battle particularly as the turning point in many ways, I mean, where the idealism just started to deflate and go down.
Well, this was also the first battle in which a great many of the participants were draftees from Britain. Prior to that, the British had been able to fight the war for the first year or more with volunteers. But by early 1916, so many people had been killed that they had to start a draft. And so this was the first time that the people going into battle were not entirely these gung-ho volunteers. And the death toll was so horrendous. On this one day, there were more than 21,000 British soldiers who were killed or fatally wounded. Many and most of them killed within the first hour.
Most of them from Devonshire.
Well, many of them were from that regiment, but there were many regiments that took an enormous toll. But, you know, unfortunately, it's not the only battle that you can point to that was waged with this expectation of a big breakthrough and then a colossal death toll on the first day. The Battle of Passchendaele the next year, it was really the same thing all over again. This time they ran the bombardment for two solid weeks beforehand, and again it didn't, you know, really knock out the ability of the Germans to inflict horrendous massacre on the first day.
You think the Germans had a hold of this plan? It was, what, a 31-page plan, and it was pretty accessible, I think.
Well, it's hard to keep secrets when you are maneuvering around tens of thousands of soldiers, really hundreds of thousands of soldiers, when there are observation planes overhead that can see, you know, supplies being moved up.
They put telephone cable and they put railroad lines.
Yeah, they laid something like 55 miles of extra railroad line. And I cannot remember whether it was this battle or Passchendaele the next year where one British general said, even the elevator boy in my Paris hotel knows the date on which the attack is to be launched. So it's hard to keep secrets when you're maneuvering around that many people in a confined space.
So was this, Joe Sacco, did this necessitate a different approach for you than past books that you've done on other wars?
Most of my other work has been journalistic, so I'm looking at the individual and how the individual is affected by large historical or political events. In this case, I was more interested in humanity as a whole. You know, I've started to ask myself questions about humanity, and this gave me a chance, approaching a topic as an artist, to think about how humans go about, you know, things like war and why they go about things like war. When you're drawing this sort of a luxury of spending time with a subject, I mean, this took me 8 months to do. So it's not just a matter of, oh, I need to draw these soldiers right and get their helmets right. That's part of it. But as you're drawing their faces, you're thinking, what's this guy thinking? Why is he going over the top? Why doesn't he stop? I mean, you think about the individuals in that way, but it's more from a distance now.
Each of them had a story. I mean, obviously.
Yeah, I'm trying to show things in a sort of more disinterested way than I normally do. But as I'm drawing the individuals, I do think each of them has a mother, you know, and it's a. You want to show the mass, but then if you look closely, you can see the individuals and maybe having even different responses to what's going on.
Well, you've got so much detail here. You're down to supplies that they received by horse. You've got the crosses at the makeshift graveyards. I mean, the details are pretty compelling, to put it mildly.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. But it's my journalistic aesthetic, I think. I mean, even when I do my journalism, I'm trying to get details right. So that just carries over into the artwork.
There is also an important point here that a lot of these, Adam Hochschild, a lot of these soldiers were upper class. I mean, the officers, like I said earlier, Eton, Oxford, educated.
Yeah, this is one of the things that fascinates me about this war and makes it different from a lot of wars, because when you think, for instance, of the wars that the United States has been involved in recent years, Vietnam, you know, Afghanistan, Iraq, it's mostly the poor being killed. You don't see a lot of sons or daughters of, you know, senators, members of Congress, CEOs fighting in any of these wars. But in the First World War, it was the exact opposite, because being an officer was traditionally an occupation for the aristocracy, for the upper class. One reason for this, incidentally, is that armies in all of the European countries, the major European countries, were often used as strikebreakers. And so you couldn't possibly entrust the job of, you know, commanding men to somebody from the lower classes. So it was very much an upper class occupation to be an officer. And when these horrific battles like the Somme, which Joe has drawn so eloquently, took place, it was these young captains and lieutenants who led their men over the top, as they say, climbing out of the trenches and into no man's land. And just to make it more convenient for the snipers on the other side, officers wore distinctive uniforms as well. So officers died at a much higher rate than enlisted men did. In the British Army, I believe, if I'm remembering the statistics correctly, 11% of the enlisted men were killed, but 19% of the officers. Men who graduated from Oxford in the year 1914, the death toll was about 30%.
It was almost like a whole generation of British men were kind of wiped out by this war.
And look at the generals. General Ludendorff, the top commander on the German side on the Western Front, lost two stepsons. The British chief of staff on the Western Front lost two sons. The French chief of staff on the Western Front lost three sons. Prime Minister of England and the Chancellor of Germany each lost a son. Imagine if, you know, the war in Vietnam had been like that. The U.S. would have withdrawn a lot more quickly.
I was thinking Vice President Biden is the only one who comes to mind who had a son who was fighting over in Afghanistan. It's also something that you said. I think I was reading an interview you did about World War I back when you were doing a lot of your groundwork and covering that wonderful book you did on World War I. But you said, you know, World War I kind of laid the ground for Nazism and communism. And I think that's right. I think also that – I'm talking about communism in Russia, of course, Bolshevism or whatever you want to call it, that if it hadn't been for World War I, we wouldn't have had reparations the Germans had to pay, and then we wouldn't have had Nazism perhaps as strong with its nationalism and its feeling of needing to strike back, and also what happened in 1917 in Russia.
I think that's true. You know, it's always interesting and risky to imagine alternative history and because there are no definite answers to it. But imagine if there had not been the war of 1914-1918. That certainly did in every way lay the groundwork for the Second World War, which came so much out of the bitterness that the Germans felt at having lost and having to pay reparations, and a bitterness that Hitler was able to build on very, very easily. Similarly, I think, you know, the creaky old Russian Empire was due for drastic changes of some sort. But it's pretty hard to imagine those changes happening in a worse and more bloody way than they did, starting in 1917 and going through all of Stalin's purges and everything else that followed. So I think, you know, I said in my book, To End All Wars, that if we could look back over the 20th century and change just one event, I think if I had the magical power to do that, I would remove the First World War from history, and I think we would have had a better history in many ways result from that.
Joe Sacco, getting back to your extraordinary work here with all this intense detail that I had alluded to, it includes, you know, a man's head exploding and pulpy limbs lying on the grass. And was there any attempt for you to limit or stave off or even censor the gore?
Well, strangely, I thought I didn't know if I could capture the gore. When I was drawing those sorts of things, I wondered how authentic I was being, because it's something I'm imagining more in a way. A lot of that comes from the fact that there are no photographic images of battle itself in the First World War, and so what I had to rely on was prose. So I would read, let's say, Martin Middlebrook's great book, The First Day on the Somme, Lynn McDonald's book, The Somme, or Somme. And I would read first-person accounts of being in no man's land. And it was from those prose accounts that, you know, as we all do when we're reading prose, we get mental images. And it was just trying to put those on paper. I sort of stylized a lot of what I drew with the shells going off, to sort of help me draw it, because I wasn't exactly sure how to draw a maelstrom like that. I could not really imagine it myself. So that was actually the most difficult part, to draw the battle itself.
So what did you do for your lack of imagination?
Well, like I say, I mean, as best as I could, I tried to take images from books. And, you know, they were talking about limbs flying and bodies being shredded by shrapnel. So, of course, I tried to imagine what this is like.
This was really, Adam wasn't kind of walking into the jaws of death. I mean, as for the British soldiers, they just were machine gunned down, as you indicated earlier, and it was just utter carnage.
Absolutely. And as Joe says, there are many, many memoirs, by people who went through this awful experience who describe what it was like. And when I was working on my book on the subject, I actually went to the area of the Somme. Did you go there and walk around?
Yeah.
Did you find that sort of brought it more alive for you in a way?
It does bring it alive, especially when you find those shells that they've piled up, to be collected.
I had one little experience there that sort of made it more vivid for me. This battle lasted for 4 months. Joe's book is about the first day, but it went on for 4 months. And about 2 months in, there's one memoir that describes British infantry officer who describes seeing a cavalry charge, Indian cavalrymen, and you've got some in your panorama, charging over the crest of a hill, and they disappear and never come back. And I wanted to find that spot. So my wife and I went there. We found the spot. And the interesting thing is when you go there today, it's not anything you would call a hill, maybe a slight rise in the ground. Mm. And then it suddenly occurred to me that this guy and everybody else who's giving us eyewitness accounts from this period is telling what it looked like when they were lying flat on the ground. Mm. And then, of course, it does look like a hill and somebody does seem to disappear over the crest.
Again, we're talking to Adam Hochschild and Joe Sacco. And let me open up a phone line. So I know there are many of you who are military buffs and historians, lay and otherwise, and you may have some questions and you may indeed want to just join the conversation. We're talking about World War I, but also talking about the art of bringing war to life, of animating it, of sort of really assailing our senses with what war was and what war is. And Joe Sacco's book really does the job here. We do welcome your calls, and you can join us now toll-free at 866-733-6786. So please feel free to join us. Again, it's 866-733-6786, and there are a number of other ways to join our conversation or to instill your questions and comments. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or go to our Facebook page or tweet us, and our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. And a listener wants to know if either you read the novels of Pat Barker about World War I. She gives very vivid accounts of action.
I haven't read those novels.
I have, and I think they are spectacular. And they were certainly one of the things that convinced me that I should follow my longstanding impulse to do a book about the First World War. I really recommend them to your listeners if they haven't read them. Regeneration, The Eye and the War, The Eye and the Door, and The Ghost Road. It's a trilogy, three novels by the British novelist Pat Barker.
We'll get to more of your emails and your calls when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're looking at the so-called Great War through a cartoonist's eyes this hour. Joe Sacco with us in studio, cartoonist and journalist and author-illustrator of The Great War, July 1st, 1916, the first day of the Battle of the Somme. And his past books include Palestine and Footnotes in Gaza. Adam Hochschild, also with us, journalist and author to End All Wars, A Story of Loyalty and Rebellion, 1914 to 1918. He also wrote the introduction to Joe Sacco's book, The Great War, and both These gentlemen will be at Mrs. Dalloway's tonight at 7:30 p.m. You can meet them, and they will be there to talk about their work. And you can also join us on this program. Email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our Facebook page or tweet us, our Twitter handle, @KQEDForum. Let me go to your calls here, and let's begin, Tim, with you. Good morning.
Hi, Michael. This is Tim in San Rafael.
Hi.
I would just like to remember my great uncle Bert, who lived to be the ripe old age of 101, and he was on British television shortly before he died because he was one of the last, if not the last, survivor of the Battle of the Somme. And unfortunately, I only met him a few times in my life, and I only remember three things that he told me. One of them was that the reason he lived to be 101 was because he had a pint of Guinness every day. The second thing was that about the battle, all he told me or remembered was that how heavy his gun was. I'm sure your guests would know what kind of gun that was and how heavy they were, but he recalled that. And the last and saddest thing is that he actually lost four brothers in that battle.
Well, as far as the gun, I mean, Adam, they were hauling 60 pounds roughly, weren't they?
They were. When you put together the gun, I think it was 200 bullets each guy had, plus supplies, water, food, other stuff.
The things they carry.
Rain cloak, yeah. And so on, yeah. But the clothing was such that it was water absorbent rather than water repellent. So when it started to rain, you know, the burden became much heavier.
We're talking, by the way, about war and art, and I mentioned earlier All Quiet on the Western Front and the poems of Wilfred Owen and poets like that. You may want to add some. One listener says, what about Stanley Kubrick's masterpiece Paths of Glory about the First World War? Did it accurately reflect the time and the particular events depicted?
Well, I think the Paths of Glory is – sort of refers to what happened in 1917 with the French army, with a mutiny of some units. And I think it did accurately depict it, you know, within Hollywood sort of strictures. But French soldiers were executed. And The Paths of Glory is really a masterpiece. When I was drawing this picture of the Somme, you know, part of me, the artist, wants to draw this sort of surreal landscape. But actually the Somme it wasn't surreal at this time. It was basically open fields that hadn't been worked over by artillery in the same kind of way. It soon was worked over by artillery on the first day and then for the subsequent few months afterwards.
And did this particular battle, the Battle of the Somme, Adam, change trench warfare? Because that's really what this war was initially.
Not really. The battle went on for 4 months, and I believe the British dead and wounded for that entire period is something like 120,000. Is that what you remember?
I think, Joe? It's more than that.
Maybe it was more than that. And probably close to an equivalent number on the German side, because the Germans were operating under strict orders to counterattack and try to seize back any ground the British had reached. In the end of 4 months, the British at the farthest point had advanced maybe 12 miles, you know, a distance you can drive in a few minutes today.
This was supposed to be a 100-yard-a-minute advance, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was the original plan. So it did not change the nature of the war. They tried to fight a similar battle exactly the same way the following year. The nature of the war really only changed in tactical terms in early 1918, a year and a half later, when the Germans developed the stormtrooper tactics and managed to seize quite a lot of ground from the British and French, exhausted their army in the process, and promptly lost the war.
Maybe another caller. Roger, that's you. Good morning.
Yes, thank you. So I think one of the central problems of the war was the British generals and planners for that war couldn't have envisioned the destructive power of the Maxim 08. They just didn't understand what a machine gun could do. And to give you an idea here, on the first day of that war, the British suffered 57,470 casualties. This is the first day. 20,000 were killed. It just shows that the people who often plan war and the generals who direct it somehow get behind and just don't understand the effectiveness of new weapons. Even today, we're building an aircraft, the F-35. Only a few of them can be used in combat. An enemy with a massive force can take them out. They just don't carry enough anti-aircraft missiles. It's just, it's so tragic.
Well, Roger, let me go to your first premise, though. I mean, how much was the machine gun really not understood?
I think it was understood by this point. I mean, the British were using these kind of weapons against natives in Africa.
I think it was understood as an offensive weapon in your hands. And really, all of the European powers, Britain, France, Germany, had been using machine guns for several decades in their colonial wars in Africa, in India, in China a little bit. But they thought of the machine gun as an instrument to be used against colonial peoples. The first and most spectacular instance of this was the Battle of Omdurman in 1898, nearly 20 years before the Battle of the Somme, where, you know, a small force of British soldiers using Hiram Maxim's latest machine gun, which fired off 500,000 bullets in a few hours and killed well over 10,000 Sudanese. So they knew what the machine gun could do, but none of the armies were capable of imagining themselves as victims of the machine gun, and they simply didn't plan accordingly.
Here's Robert, who writes, "I'm a big Sacco fan. The Fixer is brilliant, and I learned a lot from his book on the Palestinians. But as he's usually schooling us American readers on stuff that isn't covered in U.S. schools, I really wish he'd take on the Soviet experience during World War II. The U.S. suffered approximately 500,000 casualties, almost entirely military. Soviets suffered 7 million military casualties and 20 million civilian casualties. Stalingrad, Leningrad, how do you illustrate that?"
Oh, boy. That would take a lot of research, and it would take a lot of time. I mean, the battles in Eastern Europe somehow remind me of the First World War. Really, battles of attrition and battles of artillery. Not really battles of movement, except at certain points and at the end. You know, in certain places like Stalingrad, it was really pounding each other. I don't know if I want to address those topics, though.
I think the listener wants you to.
Well, how much is the listener willing to pay?
So. Yeah. Put up front money here. Let me go to another caller, and that's you, Tim. Join us. Welcome.
Hi there, gentlemen. Thank you for the conversation. I wanted to mention a great book that I found. It's called War Letters of Fallen Englishmen, edited by A.E. Housman's brother, Lawrence. And it's fascinating because these are real letters, and you get to a sense of how naive, well-educated, and well-bred most of the officers were at the wartime.
Yeah, we were talking about that, Tim. I mean, to what extent, and you see it in the poetry, I mean, the disillusionment that I talked about earlier. So many of these well-educated that you alluded to before, Adam, went off with, well, thoughts of glory and, you know, valor and, you know, women. Who was the woman that was going to be married by the one?
That's right. The 1st Newfoundland Regiment, which fought this day at the Somme and was almost completely wiped out. There was a society woman back home in St. John's, Newfoundland, who promised to marry the first member of the regiment to win a Victoria Cross, the British Empire's highest decoration.
They were they were completely smitten with the idea of war in England.
Yeah.
You know, you read some of those poems by Siegfried Sassoon and Isaac Rosenfeld and, Rosenberg, Wilfred Owen, and you realize just what they faced once they started actually getting into the warfare, as opposed to what they went off with, you know, with the streaming and the glory and, well, it's an old story, unfortunately. Let me get another caller on. Neil, that's you. Good morning.
Yeah, you've already talked about Path of Glory. Are there any other movies about World War One that you think are particularly relevant or particularly accurate?
Well, I think All Quiet on the Western Front, the first version of it, is it rings true to me.
And I like the film Gallipoli, which I think it was Peter Weir who did that.
Yeah, that's right.
Which
a great film.
Is a terrific film, not about the Western Front, but about the Battle of Gallipoli.
On a related note, somewhat related note, a listener wrote in to say that the San Francisco Symphony is marking Benjamin Britten's centenary with his War Requiem, juxtaposed with verses from Wilfred Owen. That's on November 27th and November 30th, and you may want to be apprised of that, those of you listening. Let me apprise you also of some more emails we're getting. Stuart writes, do you all know that a conservative firm has published since the printed report is widely seen as a whitewash? I'm very concerned that graphic books will be used to distort history. What do you guys think about this? I think he's talking about the 9/11 report, which is a graphic adaptation by Ernie Colon and Sid Jacobson. I mean, in other words, graphic novels can be used for propaganda.
Well,
they can be, and are.
Anything can be used for propaganda. I mean, there's just no doubt about
right.
it.
Another listener writes, please consider bringing up the illustrious styles of the Asian cultures. I think an interesting comparison is in looking at the scroll painting of Japan. The large format drawings and paintings illustrate the consecutive stages of shogun battles, from the advance through the carnage to the bloody end. The level of detail makes the pieces flat and narrative, creating little pieces within the pieces.
That's true. I mean, Asian cultures have a great scroll tradition. And I have to admit that I don't know enough about art history that it wasn't what I thought about initially. What I thought about was the Bayeux tapestry, but it's been pointed out to me a number of times now, the Asian traditions.
So you put something out there and you get a whole education, right?
You know, it's a good thing.
And a listener named Kanda writes, your speaker supposed a much better world in which World War I might have never happened. The trouble is there were great forces at play that pushed Europe into the war. What could have happened in an alternate universe to dissipate those forces so that World War I wouldn't have happened? We're back into alternate histories here, Adam. You want to speculate?
Yeah. I don't think the war was fated to happen. I mean, consider, you know, the war began end of July 1914. In June 1914, the nations of Europe were all at peace. It's true that there were two alliances, you know, France and Russia and informally Britain on one side and principally Germany and Austria-Hungary on the other side. But no country publicly claimed a piece of another's territory. Germany was Britain's largest trading partner. The royal families of Germany, Britain, and Russia were all closely related and sometimes went on yachting holidays together in the Baltic. And the royal families had much more influence then than they do now.
But speaking of royal families, as schoolboys, we all learned it was the Archduke Ferdinand's assassination that supposedly triggered the war.
That's true. But it was by such a weird series of accidents that happened. I don't think it was fated to happen. In June 1914, the British Navy sent a flotilla to take part in a regatta at Kiel in Germany. And when they sailed for home, the British admiral cabled to his German – signaled to his German counterpart, friends now and friends forever. Nobody was really expecting the war to break out.
Stuart asked, did Joe Sacco or Adam Hochschild use Paul Fussell's The Great War in Modern Memory?
I've read it, and certainly it's informed my own feelings about the war. But obviously I'm not using that book directly.
Yeah, it was certainly an important book for me, very much so. And it's one I would – another one of those World War I books that I would strongly recommend.
And we'll take more of your calls. We'll go to Stanford next. Adam, join us.
Hi, Michael. And I really appreciate the show. I'm a World War I historian, so this is very exciting for me to hear something on the radio. As far as the film recommendation goes, Junet is a very long engagement. A French film is excellent. And for a novel, Edmund Blunden's Undertones of War is a fabulous first-person account. I wanted to ask a more general question, though, which is since the Somme took place, well, you know, 2 years or so into the war, everybody who was planning it was well aware of the destructive abilities of artillery. And so the question that I think needs to be answered is not why did people how were they fooled into going, rather, but why did soldiers choose to go and fight at this particular time? And why did they continue to fight for 4 months or again in Passchendaele? So I'd be happy to take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the question.
Well,
Adam,
you're right about the film, A Very Long Engagement, a fine film. I think the novel it was made from, A Very Long Engagement by Sébastien Japrisot, is even better. Another superb film is Bernard Tavernier's Life and Nothing But, which I think is probably my favorite of all the First World War films. You asked the question, why did the soldiers choose to fight when they knew about the immense destructiveness of the artillery that would be aimed at them and so forth? They didn't choose to fight. They were forced to. They were drafted.
Conscripted.
And once you're in an army, whether you're conscripted or you're there as a volunteer, you've got no choice. And when, for example, the armies went into battle, they had what was known as battle police, who were, you know, a second rank of soldiers who followed behind those first waves, who were armed, ready to shoot or threaten to shoot anybody who had the nerve to turn around and run away, which is, I must say, a very logical thing to do if somebody's shooting a machine gun at you.
And we go to Oakland next. Tom, thanks for waiting. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. Yeah, you know, I wanted to make a couple quick comments. One is about a book called, I think it's Goodbye to All That, written by Robert Graves, the guy who wrote I, Claudius.
Yeah, very good book.
He was a guy born in aristocracy in the British Raj in India and wrote a book about how basically this war was a war fought by the aristocracy for God, for country, for glory, and basically wiped out the greatest minds of his generation of three countries, France, Poland, basically all of Western Europe that was involved. They lost their best and their brightest and really gave rise to people like Hitler and all the resentments that came out of that war. I don't hear you talk about that already. But also, by the end of World War II, two wars had been fought by those countries that had basically wiped out almost every man much over the age of 15 by the time 1945 rolled around. And so there was a real drain on everything, on all those countries that were still being felt to this day in many ways. And I think it also gave rise to 30 years of a successful experiment of the social democracy they had practiced in Europe, because there were so few old people to be supported by a large number of young people. Now that pyramid has been turned upside down, and I think now we're seeing the fallout of that whole thing, that this became the way, and all of a sudden it is just untenable. So I think that point of World War One having tendrils that to this day stretch through our society and culture, especially in the West, is a very salient point.
Okay. Tom, thank you for your call. Good to hear from you. And we'll hear next from Francis. Francis, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I'd just like to recommend a book if they haven't known about it. It's by a German called Ernst Friedrich. It's called War Against War, and it's nothing but photographs. For example, there are 10 pages in a row of what's left of faces of people still alive, but with no cheeks, no eyes, and so forth, plus pages and pages of corpses and so forth. He was a pacifist, and he produced this book soon after World War One.
You know it, Adam?
I do. Do you know it?
Yeah, I do.
And Joe, you do too, yeah?
It's an extraordinary collection of use of just the kind of documentary photography that neither side would allow to be printed during the war because, heaven forbid, it might turn people against the idea of fighting.
And we thank you for that, Francis. And we go next to San Jose. Mark, join us.
Michael, you have the best on the radio. I hope you realize that every once in a while.
Have a what? I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
You have the best show on the radio.
Oh, thank you.
I wanted to make a couple points. One, everyone that was in World War One as a combatant is now dead. The last couple of people died in the last few years. I think that's significant in some ways. The other thing, this was the introduction of chemical warfare to the world, which is pretty pertinent right now. The Germans started using chlorine gas, and everybody got in the act. And at the end of the war, we finally have a treaty to stop using chemical weapons, which is critical, I think. And then what happened right after the war was the spread of the international flu epidemic, and it turned out that American troop ships transported that very quickly over to Europe, and it killed people in 3 days, and there are actually some graphs of some of the victims, and it's pretty horrific stuff. And so right after an entire generation of European men was killed, decimated really, then the flu comes after that, which kills many more millions of people around the world, which really was the result of World War I and the transport of soldiers to Europe.
Do we know that? I don't want to sound another skepticism here, but I remember, I never heard that before, well, the transatlantic connection of the Great Flu.
I think it's true. The flu and the war were closely intertwined. You cannot exactly say that the one caused the other, but the first medically documented medically noticed and documented outbreak of the flu was on in a U.S. Army base in Kansas. Hmm. And it was just at the time that 2 million American soldiers were in the process of being shipped to Europe, and they have mapped how the vectors of the spreading of the flu spread outward from the French port of Brest, which was where most of those troops were landed. The flu was unusual for an epidemic disease in that its greatest number of victims were among young, healthy people, people in their 20s and 30s. These are just the sort of people who filled the army. Incidentally, the armies on both sides, incidentally, they also filled the prisons on both sides that held people who refused to fight, and the death toll that the flu took there was horrendous as well.
Well, there's still a lot of enigma about that flu, though, I mean, in terms of our understanding of it. I don't want to get off on that, but that was why I wondered.
Yeah, I mean, you can't say that the war caused the epidemic, but when you have millions of people being rapidly moved and in close confinement in troop ships and troop trains and so forth, it allows an epidemic disease to spread more rapidly than it would have otherwise, although it certainly would have found ways of spreading otherwise, I'm sure.
Well, Mark, I thank you for the call, and I want to get another caller on right away. Duane, that's you. Hi.
Hi, thank you. Another recommendation for a film, a documentary program called The Great War and the Shaping of the 20th Century. And it was watching that film that I really understood or became into my consciousness what a tragedy the war was. It was mentioned that the start of it wasn't inevitable, but I understand that it's also through alliances in European countries that that was a big factor in why the war started after the assassination of the Archduke Ferdinand. And then the other thing I wanted to add is that that sense of alliances is sort of apropos to today when I think about alliances that the United States has with other countries. And I wonder how we allow these, or if there could be some thought, or I think our leaders that would check out World War I and what happened would be a little less, gung-ho about going into, you know, foreign countries and letting just the alliances, letting just say, I'm going to get your back, and sort of letting pride and other things come into play to actually get us into these conflicts.
Well, there are great lessons to be learned from this war, I think, Adam, it's safe to say. You have some reflecting, you want to reflect on that, what the caller's bringing up here?
Well, I think it's the same lesson that can apply to many wars, which is that everybody thinks that when you go to war, two things are going to happen. Victory is going to be swift, and the war is going to solve problems. And usually the opposite is true on both counts. We went into Afghanistan in 2001. Victory was not swift. That conflict is still going on. And I think one can say that fighting there and certainly fighting in Iraq caused more problems than it solved for us or for anybody else.
Not to mention Vietnam and
many other wars.
And many other wars. But, you know, this war particularly, I mean, as a literary guy, I was always struck by the fact that it had such impact on world literature. I mean, I don't know if The Wasteland would have been written had it not been for the First World War. I don't know. You know, Hemingway's work came out of the First World War. Even Faulkner's Soldier's Pay, which was his first real novel. It spread. There are even those who argue that the disillusionment of The Great Gatsby came from the feeling of the First World War somehow, even though, you know, Jay Gatsby was just a soldier who had no wartime experience, at least that we knew of. I can't think of anything historically in the last century that had such a disillusioning effect on a global of artists and the way artists interpreted it. The mounds and mounds of death. I mean, certainly World War II and the Holocaust and all that also, you know, brought forth an enormous response as far as art was concerned. But the disillusionment of World War I was just suddenly turned into something almost more staggering in a different way with World War II. Like you say, it's like they're connected at the hip or something.
Joe, would you say that's true for art too as well as literature?
Yeah. I mean, I think after World War I, people came out of that war with a real question mark over their head. which I think was the despair. After World War II, I think people understood why they fought World War II.
That's the big difference. That was, what did John Osborne call it, the last good brave cause, World War II? Let me get another caller on here, and that's you, Philip. Hi.
Yes, I'm wondering if your book is going to be translated into Chinese and Japanese, because the hubris of the leaders there, Abe and Xi Jinping, seems to me leading to the very same type of mistakes and possible war that happened. It took two wars for Europeans to finally bring a European Union. There's no discussion at all in Asia about a union of Asian states, union of Asian nations. And I'm very fearful that the very same type of dynamics are at work here.
You don't have to be translated because it's all illustrated.
No, right.
Adam's essay has to be translated.
Right. That's right. Well, if only art could change political leaders' minds.
Yeah. Let's send that up as a prayer.
The book is coming out in other countries.
It is coming out.
In England and where else?
It's coming out in a French-German edition and I think in a Spanish edition. Those are the ones I know of so far.
Well, Philip says they need it in the Asian continent. We've got seconds left here. Somebody wants to know, Adam, this is probably for you. How can I find out where my grandpa fought?
Well, if your grandpa was in the British Army, there is the Commonwealth Graves Commission, which keeps track of the soldiers, where the soldiers are, who were killed in the war or buried. In the United States, I'm not sure where one would go. Do you know, Joe?
That I don't know.
Yeah, but start with the Defense Department and see what they say.
Well, thank you both. Good to have had you here. Joe Sacco's book again is out and available. It's called The Great War, and he and Adam Hochschild, will be at Mrs. Dalloway's tonight at 7:30 p.m. And thank you both for being with us on Forum this morning.
Thank you very much.
It was a pleasure.
And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank Senior Editor Dan Zoll and our producers, Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.